Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Star,
brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your
head. Laura Berger, Glenn Tibaldio with us. They are the authors of Falling in Love Again Every Day, Three Steps to True Connection for Any Couple. As a matter of fact, Laura's an executive coach and a women's leadership expert. Glenn is a CPA, a PMP. He's a project and change management consultant. They've appeared regularly on radio, spreading their right, read, and relate message. Their company is Berdio Group, LLC, and Lauren Glenn are married, and they live in Fort Lauderdale. And let's say, guys, welcome to the show.
Absolute pleasure to be here. How are you?
Oh, I am good. Thank you both for being here. You know, there's the biggest problem that we have today, and I think it's even getting worse. The divorce rate is about 50-55%, and it is growing. Second year, I think, is even worse than that. When the two of you got together, you know, you fell in love, you put it together. When did you realize that there were things in a marriage that you weren't even aware of that pop up and people have to address?
That's funny you should ask. It's a very distinct point in time. And we decided in 2006 that we were kind of gagging on our professions. We had had too much of a good thing. We were way too motivated. We needed a break. And we went off to the jungles of Costa Rica to live for a while. And the nearest traffic light was about an hour and a half away. And we were at the top of this hill. And, you know, things were great. The nature was awesome. But in such a change like that, and with less infrastructure than we were used to, and in a home that kind of didn't work the way we wanted to, being up on that hill alone together and being in such an abrupt change really peeled back layers of us that we didn't realize existed. We still loved each other. Excuse me, we still respected each other, but it was a lot at once. And so,
you know, it's an interesting point. When you don't have the pressure of the profession, you don't have the pressure of driving back and forth to work every day, you don't have the pressure of the financial pressure of keeping it all together, the cultural pressures, the news, the media, the rest of it, it's very interesting to see what happens when none of it's there and the only thing in the world is the two of you looking at each other.
Absolutely, Michael. You use the word pressure. I use the word distraction. So when you take all of those distractions away and it's just the two of you, you start to learn things about one another that was, you know, being occupied by distractions.
No, absolutely. Laura, I think the biggest problem that we have as regards to relationships is this. You and I meet, and I'm not going to show you who I am. I'm going to show you who I think you would like me to be. Now I've got this mask on. Then we get together, and I get more comfortable, and as I get comfortable, I become Michael. And 6-8 months later, this is not the guy that you met, and you say to me, you're changing. But down deep, I haven't changed. I'm finally coming out. And when you guys are alone, what I'm hearing is, the real yous come out.
Absolutely. And, you know, come from a guy's perspective, when guys end up upsetting their spouses or their significant others, when we have a problem, you know, we tend to withdraw and try to go fix it. And the female will chase, will want to talk. We like to be analytical. We like to plan out our response to things. And that's how these types of communications things, and the problems, they kind of spread like wildfire. You have a little problem at first, and then you want to go fix it, and then, you know, she comes and asks, I want to talk through it, I'm not ready yet. She gets angry, and it just becomes a perpetuating thing. And so you need a way to sit down safely and be heard in full and kind of break that cycle.
Laura, when you're in that position with the two of you all alone, basically alone, and was he the same guy that you came there with? Did you find another Glenn?
Yes, I did. So before we went to Costa Rica, you know, we were very much going down an independent career path, and I prided myself in being this independent woman. And when we moved to Costa Rica, Glenn had really stepped up to the plate in terms of navigating the country and speaking the language, and there was a dependency there that I had on him that I hadn't had before, and he was kind of leading me too. So he took the reins and he was taking the lead, and I was looking at him going, wow, I've never really seen him do that, because I was always doing it myself and not allowing him to really come in and assist. So that was new for him and new for me to experience. So it was somewhat of a role reversal a little bit.
Yeah, but the word that would come up would be, quote-unquote, survival. And that's what he did. He jumped in, and he did everything that you would possibly want to do to be able to survive in that circumstance. You could have gone to any given city in the country, and the same thing would have happened. When I say would have happened, if you have to survive. What's innate within you is going to come out when you need it to come out. Before you guys went, it didn't have to come out in him.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's absolutely right. And when we were there, there were other things that I excelled at that kind of complemented the culture much more than we ever anticipated. So I think that, and I'm speaking for Laura, it wasn't in her rhythm to work within the culture. The culture is very passive. Everything's about diplomacy. There are no outbursts. If something's not going the way you want it to go, which often they didn't, and we were used to getting things when we wanted them in a modern culture. So, for example, we didn't have a phone. We tried to get a phone for 7 months. We never had a phone. And so Laura was looking at my reactions. She wanted me to jump in and be aggressive, but being a person who, for example, is passive, she couldn't understand until kind of we came back why I was reacting the ways I was reacting. She thought I was just rolling over on things, and that even made it worse between us because she had never seen me functioning in that manner.
No, by the way, I think a great example of that is, try living in Fairbanks, Alaska for a while. When I first went up there, I was brought up in Los Angeles, fast-paced business, yada, yada. And if you get out of the city and you talk to somebody living away from the city, it's like, how's it going? Dead silence for 2 minutes. Fine. So it's learning a completely different language. And you're right. It is the culture. If you don't tie into the culture, you're going to have a lot of problems there. But what caused you to pick Costa Rica?
I think I'll take that one again because it was more on my side of the relationship at that time than anything else. There was something about the place, and I see it in people's eyes. And when we were there, I saw it in people's eyes. There's a smile at cash registers. There's a smile in restaurants. Everybody waves when you drive around. The nature is lush. It almost feels like a natural Disneyland of places, and it was laid back, it was friendly, it just felt like a place where, personally, my spirit needed to sit at the time, because as I said, I was kind of gagging on my profession, I was working like crazy, and it just felt like I was sitting in a nice, frumpy chair.
Now, by the way, that sounds like America in the 1950s. Serious.
But, I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, but we've changed. You know, I think what we're really dealing with and what I'm hearing you guys, and stop me if I'm wrong because I didn't experience it the way you did, but it's something called acceptance and identity. And we're missing that here because it's so rush. Everybody's moving, going, and doing. But when you go to a place like that, when it slows down and they're smiling because they're accepted and they have an identity of being who they are in that place at the moment. And it's a culture. And I wish we could have more of that here today.
It is acceptance and identity. And I think here in the United States, our identity is what we do. And it was very much the case that I experienced that. So when we moved to Costa Rica, nobody cared what I did. They didn't care about me rattling off, I was the blah, 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 or, you know, they didn't care because it was about who I am as a person. So So identity was a real struggle because I was always associating myself with that.
No, absolutely. Great example. I remember when I was a kid, if you had a cool car, you were somebody. But if you didn't have the car, all of a sudden you weren't anybody anymore. And I think it's one of the biggest problems that we have in this particular culture. And I would venture to guess if people were reading the book, they began to see themselves within it, the problems that they had within it, and realize that what they were missing. And you could take that what you're missing and create it for yourself, even in today's world. You guys came back, and yet it's the same. You can bring that or create that anywhere you go, but you got to know it's there.
Sure, and as a guy, you can imagine that when you're, we still are, even though society is changing, old habits die hard. We get our validation in the home is through contributing, through work, through success, through. And I'm not saying that Laura didn't; she definitely did. But for a guy, I think it's definitely innate in you. And being in a place where that was all stripped out, then you're looking at your wife and you're saying, "What do I have to contribute now? I mean, you can do the emotional stuff. We can talk up here and whatnot, but I can't, you know, excel and bring anything, and you can't admire me." So we use a technique called Write, Read, Relate to get through those issues because we were trying to cope with all those changes and getting to know the new people that we were with.
What you just said, the new people you were with, and isn't it interesting that they're not new people? They're the base of what people are and started out to be, and we learned to be different.
Yep.
We became the new people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, now, in a relationship, the communication, the ability to connect with each other, what was one of the main things that you learned?
So we, as I mentioned, we use this technique called Write, Read, Relate. And we can go into all the benefits of it and why it's so great, but essentially what it does is it breaks these bad habits we have in communicating, interrupting each other. Let me give you an example of a just one sentence that in a relationship would be very difficult to say if somebody was really upset. Yesterday you offended me, but now I forget very much, but now I forgive you. If we're hot, you're not going to get past the yesterday you offended me. So what we did was every single day, instead of getting into these fights about the same things over and over again, we grabbed notebooks, we chose a question, we wrote about it, we committed to writing for 10 minutes in silence about it. We exchanged notebooks, we read about it, and then we discussed it for 10 minutes. And that really avoided the interruption and the fighting, broke the cycle.
Yeah, but how about adding a little twist to that, okay? How about thinking that yesterday when I offended myself through you, I think that's one of the biggest problems that we have in communication. You said it earlier, you know, the blame, we point a finger, we do whatever there is to do. But when we get to realize it's all us. We recognize something in the way somebody looks, the way somebody said something, the way they're acting at the time, which usually has nothing to do with what they're meaning, but it's the way you take it. You know, talking isn't communication in any way, shape, or form. It's the response of the person on the other side that you're getting. And I think one of the most important things to get is that other person doesn't do anything. You do it yourself when you've recognized something you like or you dislike, and 9 out of 10 times, you never really get down to the core unless you realize that. It's called being responsible for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also think when you're speaking to one another, you're evaluating facial expressions or just body movement and even voice, tone of voice, or breathing, how the other person is breathing, and you are processing that and making all of these assumptions. So you're not really even listening to what the other person is saying because you're evaluating that on the spot.
No question about it. And that evaluation doesn't have to be right now. That evaluation can be something that happened 10, 15 years ago from somebody else.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, I had a, funny you should say that, because I had this luxury when we were in our past lives of sitting in traffic, lots and lots of traffic. And if Laura said something to me that I detected, there's something there, before she hung up the phone, I would think through it and think through it and think through it, and I'd be in traffic and I have nothing to do but think through it. And by the time I walked through the door, I was already hanging on my cross or dragging it behind me. And it was just bad news. I mean, and it was nothing, but it turns into something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I really believe, you know, I'm thinking of something that I've never thought of before as I'm listening to you talk. I guess it's called, if you want to be with me, if you're going to talk to somebody on the opposite end of that, if you want to be with me, you've got to be more of yourself. And I really believe that's what it is. There's these masks, these facades that we put up, and we're waiting to be insulted. We're waiting for the argument to happen. We're waiting to prove ourselves right about ourselves, that we're not worth it, and whoever it is shouldn't be with us. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that we run into today. It's just be who you are, and it's okay. If we could all have permission to be who we were, I think the world would be completely different.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the real benefits of journaling to one another rather than speaking, because you have the ability, if you're using a laptop of a backspace key, you have the ability to cross out, to say, you know, if your foot's in your mouth, you can take it out without her seeing. And
sure.
So we can actually be ourselves on paper and present our thoughts in a way that won't get us into trouble, because lots of times, you know, we have the experience of communication, we're just not that good at it.
No.
And we can go back and we can retool.
We're starting to run out of time, but let me ask you this question. Is it that we're not good at it, or we don't know how to do it? That's why I think what you guys have is a real good thing, because it's a roadmap. It's for somebody who doesn't know how to do it to say, here's an alternative. If you do this, and if it works for you, you've got a relationship, it's happening constantly, and you can move from there. That's the problem. Well, can you remember any class you've ever had in high school, grammar school, the junior high school, that said, this is how to be in a relationship, this is how to be in love, and this is what it looks like? No. You get out on the street, you get smacked, you fall down, you learn a little bit, you do something else. Some people never get it, and some people do get it. And that's where the problem is. It's taking everything you guys have gone through, consolidating into a book, and where somebody can spend a couple, 3 hours, go through it, and not have to go through all the pain and torture that they would have gone through had they not learned some of the valuable lessons and steps to get where they need to be.
It is about learning how to do it. And I think it's a combination. So, you know, if you look at media and reality television shows and relationships, it's just, there's so much, it's just all about the arguing, and it isn't about really understanding. So the technique is a how to do this. So you hear relationship counselors like, you need to communicate. Write, read, relate is the to do. It is how to communicate in an effective manner.
No, totally.
And people can really learn it. It doesn't even take the 3 hours. We have a book where it'll probably be about an hour and a half read. It's called Fall in Love Every Day. It's coming out this month. But people can go out to our website at writereadrelate.com and learn this, I'm not kidding, in 5 minutes. We have a quick reference guide out there if they sign up with 10 starter questions. They can be off to the races.
Wow. Okay, by the way, both thank you both so much for coming on tonight. We just ran out of time, but one more time, please, with the website and again the name of the book.
Sure. It's called Fall in Love, Laura.
Fall in Love Again Every Day.
Thank you.
And the website is writereadrelate.com.
You see, at time and again, it depends on the right time to take the lead. You got it. Good shift.
And as you can see, I have trouble with communication sometimes.
Hi, guys. Good night, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Michael. Bye-bye.
Good night.
There's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Marianne Block with us, licensed osteopathic physician, top-selling author of the books No More Ritalin and No More Antibiotics, and her third book, Today I Will Not Die, which chronicles how she helped her mother survive terminal lung cancer. The book today is No More ADHD, 10 Steps to Help Improve Your Child's Attention and Behavior Without Drugs. Mary, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we hear this term ADHD, and we hear it constantly. And we hear, you know, put somebody on a Ritalin, put somebody on a drug, and it's going to be fine. Mary, one of the things over the years that I have found out about ADHD, and I am not a clinician, you may have the ADHD of, I'm sorry, you may have the symptoms of ADHD, but you may not have ADHD. And if I'm a doctor and I am working with you and you don't have it and I am treating you for it, we have a problem, don't we?
Absolutely. In fact, I find that nobody really has ADHD because ADHD is just a group of symptoms that are completely subjective. So they're in the mind of the beholder. A teacher or parent or doctor who thinks children should be seen and not heard should sit quietly all day with their hands in their laps, well, they're going to think a lot of kids have ADHD. But a different teacher, doctor, parent who understands it, children are children, and they're going to move around, they're going to act out sometimes. Well, they're not going to see quite so many ADHD kids. So it's a very subjective diagnosis, and it is based on just a group of subjective symptoms.
Now, Marianne, when was it for you that you targeted this, where you really took a look at this problem, did your research, did your homework, and created what you did? Where was it in your life that made you really take a look at this?
When my daughter was young, she had chronic bladder infections. And I was just a young mother. I was not a physician. But the doctor gave my daughter, prescribed to my daughter, two psychiatric drugs, an antidepressant and Valium, for their side effects on her bladder. And, of course, I questioned it. I was like, what? Are you kidding? But this doctor was adamant that my child was not going to get well from her bladder infections if I didn't follow his orders. And as a young mother who was taught that you trust doctors and you believe that they know what's right, I followed his instructions. Unfortunately, it made my daughter extremely ill. She was taken off the drugs cold turkey and went into a tailspin that left her very, very ill for 3 years. And at that time, I just said to myself, if I don't understand what doctors know, then how can I be a good mother? How can I take care of my family? So at the age of 39, I decided to go to medical school for the sole purpose of protecting my family.
Now, by
and
the
after
way,
I...
Marianne, let me hold you up just for a second. When you went to medical school and you got that behind you, what did you see that you didn't see before? What was that let's call it the blind spot that most people see, or don't see, excuse me, when they've got an ADHD child in front of them?
Well, when I got out, I realized, first of all, I helped my daughter get well, and I realized that this same kind of attitude was going on throughout medicine. Throw a drug at symptoms. and particularly throw a psychiatric drug at symptoms. And what I was seeing at the time was so many children were being diagnosed as ADHD and being prescribed drugs like Ritalin. And about the same time I got out of medical school is when ADHD became an accepted disability. And when that happened, the schools went crazy. They wanted everybody diagnosed with ADHD because if they got a child diagnosed, they could actually get money from the government. And so they had extra money in the school, but they weren't really using it for the child because they would just tell the parent to go put the child on Ritalin. So what I realized that the same thing that happened to my daughter with bladder infections was happening to literally millions of other children, and I decided to focus on that population because I felt it was such a disservice to those children to just do a checklist of symptoms, put them on a psychiatric drug that is a controlled substance. It's an addictive drug, and which doesn't even fix the problem. It covers the problem at best, but at worst has serious side effects and consequences. So I began studying literature, the medical literature, and spending time at the library and reading the information that was out there, and I realized that there were so many underlying causes of ADHD that it was not real. It was not a, it was really just a made-up psychiatric label, and it did not address the real cause of the problem. And I focused on that, and I focused on looking for that cause and helping treat that cause and sending these children back into school, back into their lives with no psychiatric labels and no psychiatric drugs and allowing them to be the success that they deserve to be.
Okay, let's say that I'm a parent with a child that has all the symptoms of ADHD. What do you do? What are the practical steps? You see me, you see the child, you diagnose the child with whatever the symptoms are. How do we deal with it? How do we handle it? What are the steps to, and what do I have to have to be able to make sure that I give that child the most I can?
Well, when someone comes to my practice at the Block Center, which is in the Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area, and we see people from all over the world, by the way, and when someone comes in, they've already completed a 15-page history form. So I'm going to be looking all the way back before that child was born, during the pregnancy of that child, and coming forward, looking at the kinds of illnesses they may have had, the problems the mother may have had while she carried that child. And I'm looking for clues. I look at the child's diet, which is extremely important, and I have them do a full week diet diary, and that tells me a world of information. And so I make dietary change recommendations. We do some lab work to look for things like anemia. You know, you'd really be amazed, Michael, at how often a child is being diagnosed as ADHD and prescribed drugs, and no doctor ever did a blood test, ever did a physical exam. And I see kids all the time that are anemic. And when you're anemic, you're not getting enough oxygen to the brain, so you're going to have some problems. But it never gets tested. And I test them, I find the problem, I treat the problem, and the child goes on and has a good life. But we also look at other things. It's not, it's diet. There's nutritional deficiencies are associated with these same symptoms. There's lots of information in the medical literature about that correlation. Vitamin B6, for example, was shown to be more efficacious than Ritalin in a group of hyperactive boys. I mean, vitamin B6, you can just buy that over the counter.
Now, by the way, McMahon, let me hold you up again because I think this is important. Coming in to see you, you have the two-day program, and that I think is phenomenal. The allergy testing, the lab work, the digestive stool analysis. I mean, this goes on, the complete blood work. My goodness, it's so comprehensive. By the time you're done, then you'll know. And I really believe that if a parent is going through this stuff to save a lot of heartache and pain, if this starts to happen, and if you can fix it, quote-unquote, with education and nutrition and whatever it takes, my goodness, why not? I've just looked at the two-day program. It's phenomenal.
Well, it is very comprehensive, and I really think that it is the most comprehensive non-drug ADHD treatment approach in the world, because it includes both the medical approach, but also the educational. So we're looking at the whole picture of that individual. And it's not just children. Adults get to get the ADHD label, too, so we work with them as well. But it's taking that broad approach and digging deep and finding that underlying cause. And it's usually more than one cause. The diets are almost always not good. Had someone in my practice today, and I was looking at the diet, and the mother says, well, you know, that diet looks pretty good, but she's not telling you the whole truth. And I said, no, this diet doesn't look very good. So what the parent even thinks is a good diet is not necessarily a good, healthy diet that's going to keep that child from having trouble focusing, reacting, and having behavior problems.
So sure, let's change the word. Yeah, let's change the word from diet to nutrition, an extremely important word. We know that food turns into chemicals in your body. And again, I'm not a clinician, but food turns into chemicals in your body. Those chemicals have a responsibility to cause the body to function. They're going to go to certain parts of the body to allow the body to function, to do what it's supposed to do, i.e. through the immune system and so on and so forth. If the foods that you're eating do not have the chemicals that you need to allow your body to do what it has to do, you're going to be in trouble. And I really believe that nutrition has a big part of being healthy, only because you use it for what it will cause your health to be. You use it to get your immune system shored up. You use it to feel better. And a tremendous amount of what we do comes through the food that we eat.
You're so right, Michael. You know, every biochemical process in our body requires a vitamin or mineral to go from point A to point B. And so not only do I look at what they're eating, but also I add nutritional supplements, because I'm a firm believer that everyone needs nutritional supplements, because our grocery store foods don't contain the same levels of nutrients that they once did, because we're not turning our soils and alternating our crops and that sort of thing. And we're filling our foods with other chemicals and genetically modified foods and things like that. So we've changed our foods tremendously. So I strongly believe that everyone needs certain supplements, and we do test for that. We look for supplement deficiencies and see what they really do need.
Let me give you a prime example of that. I'm not going to be spot on, because I don't know, but I do know the process. Let's say that I've got an iron deficiency. So you say to me, okay, let's do some B12. So I do some B12, and I still got the deficiency. Well, there might be another supplement that would cause the B12 to go into the blood system instead of going into the skin. So it's extremely important to be dealing with somebody like yourself who knows what's going to happen to it, what's to get there, and the combination of it to cause it to do what it's supposed to do.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, the world out there is looking at ADHD so differently than I'm looking at it in my practice. And recently a study came out that found that children and adolescents who supposedly had ADHD actually completed fewer years of school. They graduated high school at a lower rate. They're more likely to use street drugs. And if that label itself is associated with that kind of result, I think we absolutely have got to stop labeling these children ADHD, because it's not being successful for them. We're failing them.
Yeah, but the other side of that,
giving them that label, and they're not doing well.
And the other side of that with those kids, if you get a lot of them are absolutely brilliant, and what we're doing is we're stuffing it, and we're not allowing them to be quote unquote everything that they can be. If somebody knows how to work with ADHD, a teacher effectively, especially in some of the schools, these kids could go on to be more than anybody thought they could be.
There's no question about that. They are often very, very bright, and it's sometimes that high intelligence that gets them in trouble, because they seem like they're daydreaming, but their minds are going way beyond what maybe the teacher is talking about, or they can't sit still because their minds are working so well, and the school isn't challenging them enough, and our schools if they're teaching to the lowest common denominator, then the kids who are so bright, instead of stimulating them, we're calling them ADHD and putting them on drugs.
No, I hear it. We're starting, Marianne, we're starting to run out of time, but I really believe when you come down to it, I did an interview 20 years ago, and it was somebody talking about ADHD, and he had had it, and the process he went through to clean himself up. But the point was, he said that, and you just said this, to keep him down, etc. He said if they would have given him a desk where he could have been standing instead of sitting, giving him something to get that attention and motivated, it would have been an entirely different story. Now, let me ask you this. Website we can find you at?
BlockCenter.com, B-L-O-C-K, center.com.
And can we buy the book?
They'll go to the allergy page, you'll see a video of a boy going through allergy testing where they can see how severe the behavioral problems and the focus and concentration problems can be and how we can neutralize those reactions and stop them immediately.
Wonderful. By the way, I knew this kid years and years ago who had ADHD. As a matter of fact, they couldn't keep him quiet. You know what happened to him?
What?
He became a talk show host. We got to do something with
That's
it. Okay.
Hey, very Marianne. Good. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me, choose the door, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Barker with us. He's the author of New Rules of Home Ownership for the 21st Century. He's a former CEO, has an extensive background in business management, land acquisition and development, home building, mortgage refinancing, real estate investment, construction, and all aspects of home ownership. And again, he's the creator of the Home Ownership, listen to this word, Sustainability Program, the 20th Century Model for Home Ownership. Barney, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Oh, and let me ask you, before we get started, should I address you as Varney or Jay Varney? What?
Varney's fine.
Okay. All right. Varney, thank you. By the way, the word sustainability, I want to go over that. It's critical. There was a time you bought a house, you didn't think of anything, but you paid the mortgage, you paid it off for dinner, sold it. That's not the way the world works today. You can buy a home and you don't know whether you're going to keep it or not. And I think that word sustainability is such a powerhouse word that is underneath every mortgage that that is let today.
That is absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. Michael, the rules of home ownership have forever changed. The old way and the current way of owning a home is currently harmful to every homeowner. The old way just isn't working. Hence, there is critical need for successful home ownership. There's a need for mechanisms that guides an individual through a process that ultimately lead to home sustainability. And what do we mean by this? Simply, Michael, is the process that combines a strategic financial plan, a roadmap, a guide that enables the individual homeowner to control his or her home, to control his money, and ultimately control his financial future. That is the purpose of the 21st century model of home ownership that I've created. It minimizes 99.9% of the risks associated with home ownership, thereby giving individuals a platform for successful home ownership, irrespective of socioeconomics.
Okay, let me put that another way. In the early part of the show, the first interview today was about relationships, how people can stay together, and sustainability. And the question that I, not even a question, the statement that I made was, where in grammar school, junior high school, or college did anybody teach anybody how to be in a relationship? I asked the same question about home ownership. No one has ever been taught how to get a home and sustain that home. So the book that you have, I think the window of opportunity for somebody to make the difference in their financial, their home life now is, here's, you're going to buy a home, here's how to keep it. Nobody has ever had that kind of information in any of the schools anywhere until today when so many people have lost homes.
That is absolutely correct. It's just, it's unfortunate that the book comes out, at the aftermath of all the calamitous experiences that people are having now in the marketplace. But one thing that is extremely important, Michael, and I think you hit it absolutely right, there is not a school that provides us with a basic education, and hence we must now take particular responsibility, to make certain that individuals do not go back, and acquire a home in a manner that actually subject them to the state of perpetual failure. I mean, it does not matter today whether you own $150,000 home or whether you own $1 million home. The principles that I've outlined in this book will be applicable in every giving situation. I mean, because the bottom line is that not only should one acquire a home, but the desire for home ownership should not be subjected to the potentiality of the prospect of foreclosure. And that's precisely what the book does. It gives you a roadmap, a systematic methodology to make certain that you do not only acquire the home, but you're able to keep that home. There are certain strategies that a book outlines that will enable any individual homeowner to do just that.
Okay, so effectively it's step by step. You take me by the hand and you bring me through the entire process. And if somebody had this before they bought a home, my goodness, the problems that wouldn't have had to happen in the first place. But let's take it the second step. What about the people who have a home and there's that possibility of they may get it taken away from them? Will the book take me through that?
Certainly. Excellent, excellent question, Michael. I'm glad you actually are doing this interview. It's an excellent question. The book allows you, what I've defined as the home ownership cycle, and everyone at some given point of the ownership process is in a precise position within the home ownership process. So let's use as an example an analogy that you just mentioned. You own a home, but now you find yourself in financial difficulty. What should you do? At this point in time, the critical element to sustaining or keeping your home would be twofold. One, there must be a strategic financial plan, and there must be an income strategy. And what the book basically does, it enables you to diagnose precisely where you made a mistake. So you're able to go back and say, well, I made a mistake because there was income insufficiency. I made a mistake because I did not have a game plan. I didn't have an exit strategy. You must know how you're going to actually exit of that piece of investment prior to your purchase. All right. So whatever the deficiency is, you're able to identify it and adequately diagnose that and correspondingly apply some of the solutions that we mentioned in the book. So an income, a financial plan is critical, and an income strategy, because the income strategy would allow you to cure income deficiencies, thereby allowing you to keep that home. So both of those plans work in conjunction with the other.
But an extremely important point here, let's go to not necessarily the income strategy, but the strategy of how to get out of it. There are ways, from what I understand, and I'm not a professional, but there are ways of letting the home go without having to go through the problems with bankruptcy and this and that and whatever and terrible credit ratings. There are ways to let that home go, and I think that in and of itself is something that people should know or have a good feel of, that they've got that alternative. Most people don't realize that. I know somebody who lost a condo a couple of years ago. It was fascinating because what occurred was she got into some financial trouble. So the bank sold the note. And then when she went to talk to the people who bought the note, they'd already sold it to somebody else. And by the time she was done, this 3 years later, she hadn't made a payment in almost 3 years. She didn't even know who to make a payment to. And the attorney that advised her said, let it go, because what you owe on that condo, you'd never get back out of anyway. So he took her through some steps and he let her go. But the exit strategy, I think, is extremely important, even if you're not planning to exit. Just know you've got something in place.
That you're absolutely correct. But also, if I may just add to that, Michael, what we want to do is to make certain that an individual does not even get to the point of foreclosure. So we have in the book what we call a preemptive foreclosure strategy. We're able to, and it's a complete analysis that a book takes every homeowner through. It doesn't matter whether you're a doctor, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a garbage collector. It just does not matter. The book is principle based. So we're able to project way in advance, utilizing the financial strategy that we talked about, to determine exactly what your risk of potential foreclosure is, thereby allowing you to avoid the possibility of foreclosure. So we adapt a preemptive approach. If you're going into homeownership today, you really want to do that analysis. You want to know what are you, and I know individuals who are looking to homeownership, you know, so excited and elated and whatnot, and so the thought of even considering foreclosure doesn't even come to mind. But it's important. Therein lies the precise period when you want to talk about, you know, the possibility of foreclosure with a financial planner, not a real estate agent. And if at all he diagnoses with you the probability of foreclosure, you want to put in place counteractive measures to avoid that long before you even approach your exit strategy, so that your exit would be a wholesome process and not one that actually subjects you to the kinds of problems.
Even if you don't need any of it, it's there and it's in place, which allows somebody to go to sleep at night and get a decent night's sleep.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely correct, Michael. Absolutely correct.
Now, what was it about when you put this together? What triggered you? What was that spark that said, you need to get into this, you need to research it, you need to put it together and make it in put it together in such a way that people could actually wrap their arms around it, understand it, and use it?
Well, Michael, and that takes me really into my personal story. Approximately 3 years ago, I owned a major construction company here in Nashville, Tennessee. I built houses. You can mind the range of houses I built with, you know, 100,000 to 150,000, what we call, you know, just your moderate price home. Had a good business going, ran into a bad partnership, and I too became homeless. I became homeless. I lost everything as a consequence of that bad partnership. But when I started my business about approximately 3.5 years ago, long before the market ever collapsed, I had concluded that the methodology or the process that individuals were going through, the homeownership, was completely disadvantageous to the homeowner. It did not matter. People could not survive the kinds of assault financially that were being imposed upon them. And so I did a little newspaper called the Beacon Digest, and I wrote an article. And to make a long story short, a lady called me and said, well, you need to expand on this article. And I started expanding and doing research and whatnot. And doing the processes of going through my own financial crises, I was able then to look almost with crystal clarity what was happening to the American homeowner. And through that process, Mike, going through losing a home, losing a business, building myself back up, I just had the clarity of thought that this book was necessary, and I was guided through the process, if you will, by professionals and whatnot, and the conclusion was 3 books in 1. And so after we did the first book, New Rules of Homeownership of the 21st Century, the second book, The Ultimate Foreclosure Recovery Plan, which allows those persons who have gone through foreclosure a systematic process of rebuilding themselves, and then the last book in the series, the New Rules of Career, Income, and Employment, because, again, career planning is taking a dramatic shift, and individuals now need to know how to build income strategies as opposed to income. And so that's how I came about writing these 3 books. It was out of my own pain, out of my own suffering, out of my own homelessness, you know, and now I want to utilize the experience that I've had to benefit the American homeowners and to show them how to navigate now through this new process of home ownership.
And the unique value proposition has been there, done that. I mean, I say that simply, but at the same time, if you hadn't had the experience, not only would you not have understood it financially, but you would not have understood it emotionally. And there's the tie between the two when you're dealing with your home. And there are so many people who have lost homes that, I'm going to use the word probably, Barney, probably didn't need to lose the home only because they didn't know what to do at the time and what process or strategy to use that would keep the house.
I definitely agree. And I'm elated that we're able to provide this as a tool now that individuals can use. I mean, it is a tool. It's more than just a book. It is an entire tool, and there's an extension to the book. I mean, if you ever went to the website, or newrootsnow.com, you'll see that we're building the National Homeowners Alliance, Michael, because I believe that there's a critical need at this juncture in our history for a national organization that advocates the interest, that advocates and protects the interests of homeowners. If you look at every discipline that affects homeownership, whether it's the the associations of appraisals or whatever it is, there is a national body. But if you would look at this critically, Michael, there is not a body out there, a national body that protects the homeowner. He's an isolated prey. And so what I intend to do with the proceeds, or some of the proceeds from this book, is to establish the National Homeowners Alliance for the purpose of bringing homeowners together under one umbrella, advocating in their behalf and creating strength in numbers, thereby allowing us to influence decisions as it relates to other home ownership desires, and as opposed to having those imposed upon us, what is by government entities, et cetera, et cetera. We need to be in control. We're the ones actually who are expending the $150,000, the $250,000, the $1 million to purchase a home. We are there who actually make these payments and then subjecting ourselves to foreclosure. So we really need to be in control, and that will become the purpose of the National Homeowners Alliance, to bring all homeowners together, because if you analyze this, you will find that there is not a body, a national body, that advocates in the interest of homeowners.
And by the way, Barney, one more time, do the websites again, but do it slowly.
Yes. It's initial J. Varnie, V-A-R-N-I-E, Barker, BARKER.com.
Okay, so all right, so we've got that. Now we can buy the book on the website, get more information. Are you doing workshops, seminars, anything of that nature?
Yes, indeed. I'm available for workshops, seminars. And don't charge anything at all. I'm willing to do this freely. And because the purpose here is to make certain that word goes out now, that there is a new model for successful and sustainable homeownership. It would be my privilege to serve any organization who would call me to help them get the word out and to utilize this program, and either to effect a change in their community or to make certain that individuals who are going through foreclosure would stop the process, but would be also capable of recovering.
Wonderful. Barney, we're running out of time now. Please, one more time, slowly with the website. And I really appreciate your time and appreciate what you're doing here. So, again, with your website, one more time.
J. Varnie, V-A-R-N-I-E, Barker, BARKER.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, Barney, thank you so much for joining us. And I think what you're doing is phenomenal, because you could save a couple of lives out there. I really believe that.
Michael, I sincerely appreciate you having me on. It's my pleasure to be with you tonight.
Take care. Now, good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. We'll be right back.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
A dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Mal Duane with us, the author of Alpha Chick, Five Steps from Moving from Pain to Power. She is Alpha Chick extraordinaire. She built a multimillion dollar real estate company from scratch, has a dream marriage, and is a certified professional life and recovery coach, deeply involved with helping women discover and use their connection with the divine power from within, also to become their own version of the Alpha Chick. Life experience, she's had a lot of it. And let us say, Mel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's an honor to be here with you tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. I really believe those words, the pain to power. There are so many people who are in pain today, men, women alike, and it's the same strength, except they're not using it in the way that's going to benefit them. Same power, it's just how it's used.
Correct.
Where did you see this? When you first took a look at this, where did you become, quote-unquote, and I say this lovingly, Alpha Chick? Where did that come from?
Well, it came over a period of time, a transformational process that I experienced personally. And it started at my lowest moment in life when I felt that there were no options left, but you know, maybe death, that was starting to look like a good one. And I started to look within and realized that all the guidance, all the answers that I had been looking for were actually all within. And instead of running around and looking for validation from other people, I started to find all of this strength within myself through a five-step process that I used.
You know, it's interesting. Did you have to, let me say it this way, from what I'm hearing you say, did you have to unlearn everything you learned to let you step out and see who you were?
Not really. What I started doing was different things, and I started with a daily spiritual practice of meditation and prayer, which I call the first step of this process, or focusing within, settling the mind down, getting rid of that monkey mind, the ego, the chatter. And then once I was able to do that, the next step was acceptance. Facing all of my mistakes, everything I had done that was painful to me and embarrassing and holding me back, and that was what my identity was. I released all of that. I accepted all of that. And I was able to free myself from it. And once I did that, I had the ability then to set new intentions about what I wanted to do with my life and take positive action steps towards those intentions. And then my thought process, you know, there's been so much written about positive thinking, but being very conscious of what I was thinking about and making sure they were good thoughts. And the fifth step in the process was I really started to feel like I had been healing, and I felt the power. I felt my strength coming back. I felt my ability to make choices. And as I was healing, I realized I needed to give this information away to help other women.
Now, by the way, you know what this sounds like? It sounds like if you really look at it very closely, Mel, it crosses the gender line. I would imagine there's a tremendous amount of men who go through the same thing that could actually use the same steps.
Absolutely. And many times when I'm talking about it with women, men say, hey, wait a minute, why can't I do this? And you absolutely can. This process can be used by male or female.
Okay, so it's real. Okay, so it's starting out with slowing down, and what you said is focusing with the meditation. Now, does the meditation have to take a long time? Can it be short? Or when you meditate, most people that do not understand meditation, you know, it's sitting 2 feet off the ground, you know, then that's not what it is. It's really centering and getting mindful at the same time. But does it take a long time to meditate and or to learn to meditate?
Not really, because it's a very personal experience. And some people can do it walking. Other people can do it journaling or through prayer or through just sitting quietly. And, I mean, when I first started, if I was able to sit for 5 minutes, I was doing well. But with time and with practice, I became better at it. And then I really felt all that craziness, all that chatter that was going on in my head started to subside so I could truly hear my authentic voice, my true guidance, what was there, answering my questions, giving me a sense of direction that I didn't have before.
Now, let's talk about it. I want to go back to a statement a moment ago and the word learning. You know, everything that we've done, behavior is learned. The way we look at things, mm-hmm. the way we feel about things, it's learned. And I've always felt, for many, many years, I felt if you can learn something, you can unlearn and then relearn. And mm-hmm. the most important thing is its meaning. So it's really unlearning to see yourself and then relearning that who you truly are inside and then acting on it.
You're probably correct. I've never thought of it that way. I thought more of it as, for me, it was more of acceptance.
Sure.
Unlearning, it was like, okay, yes, I did those things. Yes, I struggled with alcohol. Yes, I had failed relationships. Yes, I had a failed marriage. But that's not what defines me as a woman. That's not who I am.
True. No, absolutely. But it took whatever it took to get that distinction. You know, mm-hmm. we go through life and we get knocked down. There's one or two things you can do with it. Three things. One is you can give up totally and you know what the end result of that is. Or mm-hmm. you can stay where you are, or you can get up and move forward. Because the majority of the times you get hit, and it's not easy at the time you're getting hit, but the majority of the emotionally, physically, whatever it is. But when we begin to realize what wonderful lessons those are, because if you won't wake up, you're going to bring something into your life to make it horrendous to cause you to wake up. And then you took the track that you took. So my feeling about it is this, that why does somebody have to go through all of that when they can get into the program that you've got and take the steps and eliminate that stuff, anticipate the problems before they even happen to move forward and have a decent life?
That's why I wrote the book, to share this process, because you hit the nail on the head. Most people go through these terrible, very painful lessons, and that's what motivates them to make change. What if, and as you said, you didn't have to go through all of that, and you were ahead of the game, and you could make conscious choices before you had all these things happening? And that's my goal, to eliminate women from suffering from the failed relationships, from the failed marriage, from the loss of a job. What if they could be empowered before these things happen so that they deal with them much better or completely eliminate them?
Sure. And how about if I can recognize it when I walk into it so I don't have to fall into it?
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. Exactly. So that you're not brought to your knees. You can deal with it.
No, absolutely. I give you a prime example of that. I remember this. I can see it. I can feel it. I'm in the car. I'm in love. I'm 16 years old, and I'm I mean, this is it. This is the be-all, end-all, right? She looks at me, and I took her home, and she looks at me, and she said, there's somebody else. She fell for an older guy. The older man. The older man was 18 years old, and he was just a sophomore in college. And she said to me, "He's more of a man than you'll ever be." Now, at 16 years old, my thought was, "Well, I can kick his whatever." Okay, but then as I grew, I began to learn truly what the definition of a man is: the ability to take responsibility and so many other things. But it's where you are in time, time and place, and what defines life at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And she fell in love with an older man. I don't know if I can deal with that.
And how long did you carry that pain with you?
Oh,
are you over it now?
You know, anybody older than me now may not be around, I'm kidding. But the point is, I carried it for a while till I discovered it. And I discovered it, you know, when I was in my early 20s, I began to realize that life is a little different based on where you are, and it's how you look at it. And it's all got to do with the words that you hear and your experience of those words.
Mm-hmm. But you made a very conscious decision about that. Most people don't, Michael. They carry that pain, those harsh words, that rejection. Women carry those things for years. And then they wake up 20 years later and they go, oh, my God, I'm still suffering from that. I still hear those words. It still causes me pain. And that's really what happened in my own life until I got to a point where I just couldn't go on.
Yeah. And I bet you came to this place, too. And there's a place that I came to in life over the years, et cetera. Try this out. Radio Susie's sitting here going, he's going to do it again. Ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Michael, are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that. Absolutely, and if you don't think so, somebody else will.
Love your answer, but I looked you up, and I know you're attractive.
But think about this. If I had, and this has to do with what we're dealing with, if there was five women standing in front of me right now, Mal, if I could walk behind each one and see through their eyes, if I could look at me, I would see five different Michaels. Some of them are going to think I'm really attractive. Some of them are going to think, oh, the worst thing that ever happened. I can't please everybody. So is it rejection, or am I looking for something through someone that's never going to happen? So why don't I hang out with the people who think I'm pretty?
True.
Yeah.
We should associate with people that appreciate us. But it's not something we always do as women.
Yeah, but truly, when you talk, I think I brought this up because of rejection. Are you really being rejected? Or is it that person that just doesn't know how to deal with you, doesn't appreciate you, doesn't all of those things, and the rejection could be the best thing that ever happened to you?
Absolutely. Could be.
Yeah. So realistically, is it really rejection? I think there's, and I can see that everything you do here is that shift in thinking about how you live your life and things. You shift your thinking. The same thing can happen, except the end result, the reaction, is completely different.
Yes. Your perception of what's happening, you're coming from a different place. You're coming from a place of power now.
Yeah.
And not from weakness.
Yeah, and it's your own personal power. That's where the key is. Can't get it from anybody else. You can't be like anybody else. My optimum best, I can only be the second best you. No, Mal, no matter what I did, I could never be as good at being Mal than Mal can. So my job is to be the best Michael I can. The problem I think that most people run into is they're trying to be someone else, and it doesn't work.
Absolutely. Or they're trying to live up to somebody else's expectations of them.
Go. Yeah. Yeah. No,
and
absolutely.
That's failure. You just set yourself up for failure.
Yeah, there's no way you're going to do it. I really believe it's taking responsibility of who you are, identifying yourself as yourself, and the most important thing is give yourself permission to be okay.
Perfect. Perfectly said. I agree with you. Yes.
Okay, now, I picked the book up. I'm a woman now. I picked the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Mm-hmm. What's my takeaway? What do I have that I didn't have before I read the book?
several things. One is that you have the ability to make choices, and lots of times we don't feel that we have that ability. And to learn what really matters and what's important as far as our own personal development and who we are as women, and how we can become awakened and develop an affirmative approach to our lives and become the creators of our own lives. We create our own destiny. We create our own lives. We don't have to give that power away to somebody else. We have that ability, and that's what I want women to understand.
No question about it. And I think there could not be a more powerful weapon or tool to use to go out and live your own life. You know, women today, there was a time, there was no question about it, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, a woman didn't stand a chance against the man in the business world and so on and so forth. Doesn't work that way anymore, you know, because we're in a place where if you believe in yourself, there isn't anything that you can't have or can't go after, and there's nothing that can stop you today. You just have to believe that and get that impetus within yourself and go get them.
I agree. And one thing that I am very happy to see happening is that women are becoming more vocal about the fact that their lives are not right, that something is wrong, something's missing, that they are in pain. Where years ago, women could live in terrible relationships and marriages for years and years and never vocalize what was happening. But there is a shift where women are saying, this isn't right, this doesn't feel good to me, and I need to do something about it. Now, how do I do it?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is I'm gonna, tonight. This is the third time this has happened this evening, and I believe this. There was an interview early on about relationship. There was an interview also about how to protect your home. And mm-hmm. what I'm going to say applies to this also. The problem is they don't teach this early on, what you're teaching. You don't get it in the grammar schools, the junior high schools, the colleges. You don't get this information. So what do? You go through school, you do your thing, your culture dictates how you look at the world. You get out of school and nobody prepped you for being who you are. Nobody prepped you to be in a relationship. Nobody prepped you to be the most you can be. You have to go out and learn yourself, and there's a lot of pitfalls on the way, and there's a lot of pain. There's a lot of damage that gets done. But there are people like yourself who've gone through it, been there, done that, and say, okay, this is your alternative. And it's not just, yeah, sure, you can say that. You've been there. You know. It's not just academic. So it's very important that people like yourself are out there talking to people that don't have to go through this if they don't want to. Get it out of the way before it even happens.
Absolutely. That would be ideal. And my mission is to try to get this information in the hands of either mothers or young girls so that they can start to learn this process of empowerment, so that they can eliminate many of the pitfalls that you talk about that come along our path.
Sure. Sure. Mal, we're just about out of time now. Website mm-hmm. we can find you at?
Yes, sir. www.alphachick.com.
Dynamo.
Tons
Mal,
of information.
Can we buy the book there?
It will be released on February 14th, Valentine's Day. I wanted women to give themselves a gift of self-love.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated it, and I've enjoyed you being here.
Michael, thank you. I'm honored to be a guest with you tonight. Thank you again, sir.
Good night.
Nighty night.
Go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Rabbi Rami Shapiro with us, holds a PhD in religious studies and is a congregational rabbi for 20 years now. He's since shifted his focus to his own spiritual practice, writing and teaching. He teaches comparative religion, Bible, contemporary American spirituality, and Middle Tennessee State. That's where it is. And is an award-winning poet, and an essayist, and his books include a series of Rabbi Rami guides, including Guides to God, Psalm 23, Forgiveness, and Parenting. And let us say, Rami, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. That little blurb on the intro was my cat walked over the computer, and I thought I was going to lose everything. It happens to us. Now, by the way, when we are dealing with spirituality, Can we actually define what that is? There's most people who, you hear a word, and you may not understand quite what the meaning of that word is, and you get off track. So when you're talking spirituality, where does that come from? What is the definition of that?
Okay, well, I can share my definition, right? I mean,
please,
there's lots
please.
Of them. For me, spirituality is the practice of living in the presence of the divine. Which sort of begs another question about defining the divine. But spirituality is not a feeling, and it's not a creed or a belief system. It's really a series of practices, contemplative practices, meditation, chanting, I mean, there's lots of them, that bring you outside of the small s self, you know, the ego that's all about me, mine, and all of that, and brings you into that larger reality, which you can call the divine or Tao or reality itself or God.
You know, what I found a lot of it when you deal with spirituality, Kabbalah has been very interesting, because if you go all the way back, and I'm not an expert, but if you go all the way back, you'll find there's a lot of offshoots from Kabbalah and spirituality, bringing, manifesting the unmanifested to the physical world of reality. And I really believe when we're dealing with spirituality, we're really dealing with that inner self that most people are so confused and so busy that, Rami, they never get to feel it, experience it, and there's got to be steps to do so.
Yeah, I think that's exactly how I understand it as well. And I'm not sure they don't experience it. I think that the experience is so outside the norm that they dismiss it. You know, that we have these flashes of, oh, what would you call it? Flashes of just feeling connected to everything. And, you know, it usually happens when you're not trying to do it. You know, you're walking along the beach and suddenly, bam, it happens, or at a sunset or a sunrise.
Sure.
And suddenly you just feel this connection. And in my own experience, when that happens, there's a sense of compassion for and from everything. I'm not sure it's that rare. I think that it's very fleeting. and people don't know what to do with it when it happens, and they let it slip. But I think it's not something that people don't understand. It's just they don't know what to do with it.
Well, is it also, and this is a question now, is it also the inability to recognize it? And I think that in and of itself is key. And if you don't know it's there and don't understand the dynamic of it, you're not going to recognize it when it's in front of you.
Right. That's right. And what I try to do, and lots of other teachers try to do who work in this field, is to provide a framework of understanding so that when it does happen, you go, oh, that's what that was. Because if you don't have that, you know, if you don't realize there's a larger sense of self than the ego, then when you experience that, you don't know what to make of it.
Sure. And by the way, I think it's all universal, because if you go underneath the religion, I think what you find is the spirituality, the quote that you've said, Judaism is my mother tongue, yet in matters of the spirit, I strive to be multilingual. And in the end, however, the deepest language of the soul is in silence. That transcends everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the things that's happening in this country is a move toward spiritual but not religious. And I think what people are saying when they move in that direction is that they're having this sense that there is a deeper reality that goes beyond religious norms and the differences that religion invents and then enforces. And they don't want that anymore. They're looking for something else. So they think they have to give up religion and go in a different direction. But it's not necessarily so that you have to do that. I mean, people who are can be very rooted in single faith and still be able to go beyond it in their contemplative practice.
I've seen time and again, Rami, that the situations whereby you would compare particular some religions to bureaucracy. In a government, you know, we have elected officials, and then we have people who are hired. They're paid people to help run the government. That's the bureaucracy. And sometimes that stands between those people that we elected and what we want to get. And in some cases, religion is like a very strong bureaucracy. It hides, it cloaks what the reality of things are, because in those particular religions, whatever they are, there are rules, and those rules, if you don't follow, you know, God's going to get you. And I think today people are starting to get, they're taking a look at that and saying, is that really what God is about?
Yeah, right. And I think they're saying, and their answer to that is no, that God is not about that. I think your statement about the bureaucracy is accurate. I don't think you can have a organized religion without very strong organization. I think that religion at its best is there, I mean, without religion, without Buddhism, for example, we wouldn't have the teachings and the practices of the Buddha.
Yeah.
In addition to that, we have all kinds of cultural accretions that I would say are unnecessary. And the same with Judaism. I mean, without Judaism, we wouldn't have the texts and the teachings and the practices. But in addition, there's so much else that goes on with that that, you know, maybe isn't the real heart of the faith. So I think that's true for every religion. And people who are looking for something more direct than bureaucracy just can't seem to get beyond the bureaucracy, because the religions, in many cases, don't offer anything more. You know, they almost teach despite themselves, as opposed to having ministers and priests and rabbis and gurus and swamis and
sure,
et cetera, who are really trying to reach a deeper spiritual level. And, some of that
example.
Is... I'm sorry, guys.
Two prime examples of that. One is, years ago, I remember opening up a letter with somebody, and it was a man probably in his early 70s at the time, and I opened the letter. It was a particular business I was in at the time, and it said that he should be, or what was it, he should be tithing more to the church. This isn't a command, but it's a suggestion. Now, this came from a secretary, none of the religious leaders in the church. The other thing that I saw happen about 2 months ago, I almost fell off my chair. I was flashing through the TV, cable on a Sunday, and there was a very powerful, I don't know who it was, but one of these real strong the religious leaders, and he's telling everybody about this and that and to get miracles, but you got to send your $1,000 in, and if you send your $1,000 in, there's going to be a miracle. Now, I swear to you, behind him was a sign, And I saw it, and the sign said, miracles are not guaranteed. Yeah. This is on TV. So, but the point of contention, that's why people are starting to step away. It's not spirituality, and whatever religion anybody is out there, whatever you are, that's not what it was meant to be.
Yeah, I think that that's true, too. I mean, you're talking about the prosperity gospel movement, and that is all about money, and the idea is that God wants everyone to be rich, starting with the pastor who's promoting the idea. So, that gets very problematic.
Yeah, and absolutely. So when it really comes down to it, it causes people to be confused about what it truly is. Let me very quickly give you an idea of how I found my spirituality some probably 40-some-odd years ago. And then when I began to realize something, I was laying on the beach in Southern California, and it's a gorgeous night. I mean, the stars are out like you wouldn't believe. And I'm laying there, and I'm having a good time. There's some music playing. And then I started to think, well, what's beyond that? And, you know, we have linear minds. There's a certain level that you can think. And then I thought, well, it's got to stop. And then I thought, how can it stop? And what's beyond that? I actually scared myself. But what came out of that for me was this. It's the undefinable. God is the undefinable. And if you can think you can define the undefinable, you may have a problem there. And it got to that point where it is in the silence, and it's not the definable. It's what you experience from it.
Right, and that's where religion has its biggest problem, because while religions will say God is undefinable, the implicit in any religion is the notion, except we know how to define it, her or it, you know, that is absolutely problematic, especially, I mean, my basic belief is that any God that you can fit into your theology is not God. So
well, you got there's a
problem.
There's a problem also when they say, God hates this. God will get mad at you. How can God hate? How can an omnipotent being that is so beyond description have human emotions? And if that were true, I think we'd be in trouble.
Well, and even if it's not true, we're still in trouble because there are so many religions rooted in the idea. And as long as that's happening, it might as well be true for all practical purposes. It is, because you scare people, you get people to do things they wouldn't normally do in the name of God. And some of it's good, I suppose, but a lot of it is not. It's very difficult to get people to blow themselves up, but they'll do it for God. And they won't do it for you. You know, if I walked over and said, I really need you to go and blow yourself up. Chances are they're going to go, no, I don't think so, not today.
Say,
but if
what
I
are you smoking?
That's
what
God wants.
No, and by the way, I got it loud and clear. And I think what's gone on is we've lost, in general, we've lost the definition of what God is, the meaning of what was in the Bible. The Bible was written, and I'm not a Bible scholar, but the Bible was written symbolically. It was written in metaphor. It was written in such a way that the people who wrote it got protected so they wouldn't get killed. And the biggest problem, the transition to today, is they're interpreting it literally. And there's the problem.
Yeah. I teach Bible at the university, and one of the first things we do, in fact, it starts on Thursday, one of the first things that I'll do with my students is talk about literalism and versus metaphor and allegory and all these other ways to read the text. And, a lot of them, because of where I live in Middle Tennessee, they are quite fundamentalist in their training as far as what the Bible says. And I say, okay, so let's say the Bible is literal. When Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead, is he talking about zombies? Well, clearly he's not talking about zombies. So he's speaking in metaphor. So now you have to be able to go back and see, well, if he's doing it, maybe other people are doing it. And we have to look at the biblical stories as metaphors, parable, teaching maybe, in most cases or many cases, eternal wisdom and truths that are valuable at all times, but also a lot of stuff that just worked thousands of years ago and doesn't work now. I mean, the world that we live in is not the world of the author of Noah's Ark.
No, I did it. I did an interview.
We have to recognize that.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I did an interview about 20 years ago, and I was in Fairbanks, Alaska, and there was a rabbi up from the rabbinical council out of Southern California. I had a Catholic priest there. I had somebody who was Protestant, somebody who was something else. There were four of them. And I opened the I opened the interview with, if Jesus would walk down the street today, what do you think he would say about the way people are using his name? Now, that went on for two solid hours. Okay. And by the time that we got about two-thirds of the way through it, we went on break, and the kid, and he was only about probably early 20s, he was a pastor, he looked around the room, and he looked at the rabbi, looked at the priest, and he said, I didn't realize we could work together, which was amazing. But at the same time, there was a connection there, and they didn't get it. And then finally, the younger ones walked out of there realizing there was something more to what they had to offer and what other people had to offer.
Yeah,
I know. What do you say to that? Got it. Okay, I picked the book up.
I mean, like you're saying, it's great when someone gets the insight, and it's sad that the rest didn't.
Absolutely, no question about it. Okay, I picked the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael, get that I didn't have before I read the book?
Which book are we talking about?
This is the one that we talked about. This is the guides, the series.
Okay, so, I mean, there's four of them out right now. So you're talking about the God one, or?
Well, the God one, yeah.
Okay, sorry. Don't mean to be...
No, that's okay.
But
that's
I don't know which one we're talking about. The idea of the God book... I mean, the idea with each of these Rabbi Rami guides is to take a different look at the topic that I was given to write about. And in the God book, I'm looking at what's called the perennial philosophy. Sometimes it's called the tradition with a capital T. But there's this theory that throughout time and in the mystical traditions of every religion, there is a common set of teachings. And they start out with that everything is God. So God is defined as reality with a capital R, and the universe that you and I can see, touch, smell, either directly or through our technologies, is God manifest in a way that allows God to be tapped by these senses or the technology. So like William Blake said, the world that we can experience is simply that aspect of God available to the five senses. So we've gone beyond the five senses with our technology, but it's the same theory. Everything is God, and God is bigger than everything. So that's number one. Number two is that means you're part of it also. And that's where the spirituality comes in, because you don't, normally know that. One doesn't normally know that. So you need a set of practices, and all the religions offer them, that will take you beyond the ego into that broader reality. It's like the ego sees itself as a wave and God is the ocean. And as you go deeper and deeper into the self, into that wave self, you realize you are the ocean, just not all of the ocean. And then once that realization comes, the third point is your engagement with life is rooted in, I mean, it sounds trite, but rooted in love and compassion and justice. You love your neighbor as yourself because you realize your neighbor is yourself. So those teachings are found in all of these traditions, but they're not limited to any one of them, which means no one can lay claim to them. This is our truth and we have it and this is the one right way to be. No, all of these religions have it and they all can take you there. And when you get there, do you need the religion? I mean, that's a question that people have to answer for themselves. My own sense is it's irrelevant. If you choose to keep within a specific faith and it's rooted in that principle that we're all God and it's all about treating each other with compassion and kindness and respect, that's fine with me. If you decide, you know what, all I need are these truths and the way to experience them, and I don't need the label of Jewish, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, etc., that's also fine with me. But the God book is about this eternal set of teachings and how to realize them in your life.
Well, I mean, I was sitting at a restaurant with somebody one day. We're starting to run out of time, but I was sitting in a restaurant with somebody, and the subject of God came up. And whoever that person was, I can't remember at the moment, but I remember it came up, and she looked at me and she said, well, what is God? And I picked up the cup of coffee I had. I said, this is God. And I picked up the knife and I said, this is God, and the fork, and this is God, and the table is God. Because when we really come down to it, spirituality is everything, not just the connection of human beings, but it's everything that we've created and what we've manifested.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm teaching this class right now, and that is such a difficult concept for people to get. How can I be God? Well, you're God the way the wave is an ocean. You're not all of God. But, you know, when people say, well, I'll ask them in my classes, you know, so what is God? And they always, oh, God is the infinite. Okay, if God is infinite, then God has got to be that knife and that fork and you. If you say God is infinite, but God isn't me, then A, God is no longer infinite, and B, you must be an amazingly powerful being that you can keep God out. It just makes no sense. If you believe, no, you know, if you don't believe God is infinite, you believe God is a being somewhere finite in size and power, that's a different theology. But my experience is, through meditation and other things, that God is that absolute reality that embraces and transcends the universe that you and I experience.
Yeah. There was an interview that happened a couple of months ago, and it was the person, it doesn't really matter who it was, but they were talking about God. They were talking about free will, you know, and why do we have war? You know, what's God letting us do with war and with violence and killing and whatever? And I let it go. And at the very end of it, I thought very hard about what he had said. And my comment was this: I'm going to give you a prime example of free will. You want people to stop killing people? Stop doing it. You've got the free will. You were brought in with it. And if you want to stop it, you stop it. If you want to continue it, you're continuing it. But in the end result, we were given the opportunity to make sure that whatever happened in our life was that we were responsible. You come to this earth and you get this life, and you get this hand of cards and you get it dealt to you. Then it's your responsibility to play it the way you're going to play it. You want it bad, you're going to get it bad. You want it good, you're going to get it good. And that, in my heart of hearts, Rami, I think is free will.
Well, you know, I'm not exactly sure I buy all of that. I mean,
I'm not sure
about the last part. If you want it good, you get it good. I think you get what you get, whether you want it or not. I don't think God has a... I don't think God wills good and bad. You know, in the book of Isaiah.
Hmm? Yeah. The end result of that is God doesn't will it. You and I do.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Got it. We're starting to run out of time. Website, please, we can find you at.
Yeah, my website is rabbiramy.com.
Wonderful. Okay, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, my media name is Michael Ray, but there's another name that I go by, too. It's Rachmiel Reuven. So with that, good night.
Well, good night. Thank you for having me on.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Rosemary Boyd with us, the author of The Spaghetti Set, Family Served Italian Style. It's a novel. She grew up in an Italian section of Trenton, New Jersey, called The Burg. And to the background music of her mother's native tongue, she danced around old world customs and traditions practiced by the local immigrants who lived there. Her favorite annual tradition was the Feast of Lights. It's a weekend-long festival to honor the Madonna di Cassandrino, I hope I said that right, and was celebrated in the streets just outside of her doorstep. Let us say, hi, Rosemary, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Did I fall on my mouth on that one? Madonna
no,
di...
you did fine. Madonna di Cassandrino.
Madonna di Cassandrino. I got it. By the way, I was brought up...
There you go.
I was brought up with all Italians. Every one of my friends, from the moment I can remember, everybody was Italian. So, believe me,
oh,
I know.
Great. Then you feel at home with me.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, one of the now I can say Madonna di Cassandrino. Now the one thing
very
that
good.
I do, the one thing that I got loud and clear about Italians when I was growing up, family was so strong. And one of the keys, yeah. And I really believe in my heart, if people would practice that more and more today, we would not have the problems that we have in this country.
I agree with you. One of the reasons my book is set in post-World War II New Jersey is because family ties were so much tighter in those days.
Yeah.
And that is why I chose that time period.
Yeah, and look at the kids today. Can you imagine walking into your house when you were a kid and opening your mouth to your mom and dad? I don't think so.
No. You respected your mom and dad and your teachers and the nuns at school.
Yes, and the hair on the back of your head stands up when you think about opening a mouth to your mom and dad. But that was a time ago, and the kids don't have it today. That's why I believe that one of the things that we can learn from Italian families is how to be a family. Because no matter what happened, you knew if there was a problem, you could run home and they got your back.
Or they got your backside, either way.
Backside. No question. What was it? What caused you to put this to pen? Why did you decide to write this?
Well, obviously my family is Italian, even though my last name right now doesn't sound Italian, Rosemary Boyd. I was born Rosa Maria Maisto. And I'm so proud of my Italian heritage, I decided to write a book about it. I wrote it after I took an Italian language class at the local community college, and my friend and I, Carol Bettino, we went to Italy for a vacation and a tour. And when I came home, I said, I have to write about this. I have to write about Italians and what it means to me. And the book is it's a light fiction about two Italian families, and it affirms the old adage, family is family, like it or not.
Yeah, good for
so
you.
Even though you don't always like your relatives, you have to love them and you have to live with them.
That's right. Hey, by the way, I'm old school like that. But let me ask you this. When you went to Italy, obviously you were brought up the very Italian in the world, in this culture. What was it like going there? What did you see?
Wonderful.
What did you experience?
All sorts of things. And I just loved hearing people speak Italian, and I tried to speak some Italian with them, but they heard my English accent, and they wanted to practice their English, so it was kind of hard to get some Italian in there. But the country's beautiful. I went on the tour of southern Italy, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
By the way, did you find the Italian Italians different than the American Italians?
Oh, I think so, a little bit. The Italians that came to America, they were looking for a better life, and they have a different attitude They appreciate being here in America. And the Italians in Italy, they want to be Italians in Italy, you know. So it's you know, it's a different culture.
Now, by the way, the culture that you were brought up in here, the Italian culture, obviously your last name isn't Italian now, but the question is that your married name, right?
Right. Rosemary Boyd is my married name. Right.
Wait, okay, Boyd. Now, there's a reason I'm asking that. So Boyd does not sound Italian. What was it like for your husband? I got that. But what was it like for your husband to live in the culture?
To join us in our Italian family?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
He tread it lightly. My mother, the first thing she said to him when she heard we were getting married, she said, okay, now you make sure you let Rosa Maria take care of the checkbook. And he didn't like that very much.
But he loved
the Italian food, and my mother loved feeding him, so...
No, what more could you ask? By the way, that's a very important thing that you just said. A lot circles around dinner time. You know, we talk about Italian food. One of the things that we missed today, Rosemary, is sitting down with the family and having dinner together. We're so fast, so rapid. We live in this crazy, microwavable, fast-paced world that family is starting to get diluted. Family today is not what family used to be, whether you're Italian or anything else. We're starting to lose that. And I think the book would spark that old experience, that old feeling back up.
Right. There are many scenes in the book that are around the family table. And communication, you know, between relatives and seeing each other and knowing what's going on with each other. And the humor... that goes along with it, you know, putting up with the idiosyncrasies of different relatives is what the book is about.
Okay, and is it in a comical way?
Yes, it is. There's a lot of humor in the book. There's tears and humor and all sorts of things. It's about it's about relationships, and if you don't have some humor in it, you're going to have tears.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a question. Is it going to become a series? Are the members in there strong enough to continue on to the next book about the family?
Probably, but I am writing another book right now, but it's not to do with the same family. It's about an Italian-American menopausal woman who spies on her neighbors, who lives in Prescott, Arizona, where I live right now.
That's got to be the fun
stuff.
The
characters in the spaghetti set definitely have strong personalities. And what I envision is a TV series or a movie.
Okay, and why not?
It would make a great one. I think it would make a great one.
Okay, so people are going to resonate to
it. Any of you producers are listening.
people will resonate to the book in their own way and recognize themselves within the context of within the content. And I think when you deal with families, no matter how different they are, you got to recognize something.
Right.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you, I hate to do this to you, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes. My website is thespaghettiset.blog.com. And the book is available on most online bookstores, including Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble's, and many others. You could easily find it. Just type in the spaghetti set, and it'll take you right there.
Wonderful. Hey, Rosemary, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Good night.
Bye.
The curtain's fallen, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say, dismiss. That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening.
Da-da-da.